My name is Jonathan Earl. I'm a professor at Louisiana State University, and my new book is called He Has the People, Abraham Lincoln and the Election of 1860, and it's part of Oxford University Press's Pivotal Moments in U.S. History series.
Well, I didn't know that. I need to pay closer attention.
Cool, right?
Yeah. Jonathan Earl is a professor, but he also serves as dean of the Ogden Honors College at LSU, and he's a professional historian. He's authored and edited many books and articles that focus on the antebellum period. I recently spoke with him about his newest book, which looks at Lincoln in the 4 years leading up to his unlikely nomination and election. Here's our conversation. It was a pivotal moment in history. He Has the People begins with John Brown's execution after the raid on Harper's Ferry and ends at the election of Abraham Lincoln in 1860. In your introduction, you wrote, "All of us too easily assume the mythos of the American story, that it was meant to be that a fully self-realized boy born in that Kentucky log cabin would make it to the White House during the nation's severest crisis." What did you want to explore with this book?
Oh, that's a great question. I'm a professional historian, and I will do a quick critique of my professional colleagues and myself. Sometimes when we write about the past, we kind of forget how historical contingency affects everything. The people that are living this history often don't know which way it's going. And I was very frustrated when I would lecture to my undergraduates about how the textbook talked about really important contingent events like the election of 1860. It's just like, of course it was going to be Lincoln. Of course he was going to win. Of course the Civil War would happen the way it did. And that's not good history, and it's boring. So one of the things I wanted to explore in this book about, it's about one election, it's not very long, it focuses on the story of the election itself, and I wanted to make it seem like it really was the time. There are big, crazy events coming in all directions affecting the people that lived in 1860, and you're right that John Brown begins the narrative, and believe it or not, Kansas is all over the story. Kansas was one of the big issues in the election of 1860.
This book isn't very long. The time period isn't very long. But before you even begin the book, you include a sort of cast of characters. There were a lot of moving parts in this history, even though it wasn't very long.
That's true. And I had to argue with my editor to get that dramatis personae section at the beginning. I want people to be able to refer back, like, who's Horace Greeley? Who's Mary Todd Lincoln? You got to go back and check sometimes. So yes, a lot of moving parts and a lot of people. And like any election, it's just a lot happening all at once. What was that movie? Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. I love that.
So your title, He Has the People, it was in a chapter titled Chicagoland. A Lincoln supporter yelled, "Abe Lincoln has no money and no bullies, but he has the people." Can you talk about this Republican nomination and the tight vote between Lincoln and Seward?
Yeah. The way to start that, another great question, is that no political professional a year out would have considered Lincoln even in the top 15 likely presidential nominees. And one way that historical contingency affects this election is the selection of Chicago as the site of the Republicans' only second presidential nominating convention. That is Abraham Lincoln's home turf. And he came into that convention with his lieutenants, had scooped up a lot of the tickets for the crowd. They had taken all the key locations in the wigwam, which was the purpose-built building, and they were faced with some really stiff competition, especially from a New York senator named William Henry Seward, who came in, he's who that person was referring to in the title, came in with all the money and all the bullies, people to kind of, you know, promise jobs, bribe people to vote for their candidate. And it was kind of a stunned Lincoln supporter that came out of that convention after the third ballot when Lincoln won and said he didn't have any bullies, he didn't have any money, but by God, he had the people. That was not my working title. My editor, again, Tim Bent, I'll shout out. He's like, "There's your title right there." And I had not seen it, but I love that quotation.
You know, I also noted in that chapter, I noted the instructions that Lincoln gave to his, you know, lobbyists in Chicago. "Be careful to give no offense and make no contracts that bind me." Can you talk about his strategy?
So everyone knows that one of Abraham Lincoln's many nicknames is Honest Abe, and he was. He was scrupulously honest in his personal life and his finances. And I should probably set the scene a little bit by explaining that the James Buchanan administration, the sitting president, was one of the most corrupt presidencies of U.S. history to that point. So Lincoln knew that one of the ways that he could make contrasts between the Democratic Party and the Democratic candidates, and there were two of them, was by being scrupulously honest. So I think he was being sincere, telling his lieutenants, don't make any promises in Chicago that I'm bound to have to answer for. But then they did. So it's a way of looking at how politics worked in the 19th century. The candidate is blameless and is above the fray, and his guys are giving away postmasterships in Boston at a furious clip. But I do think that if you're looking at levels of corruption, this was a very low level of corruption. And then let's get to the other part of that quotation. It's don't give any offense. Lincoln knew that he was almost nobody's first choice as the convention began. So he said, why not make me everyone's second choice? And then if the front runners falter, which they did, I could be there standing ready to accept that nomination as a dark horse.
You had a couple of chapters focusing on how the Democrats were in disarray. What was happening here?
So I do have a couple presentist jokes, and if you follow politics today, the Democratic Party is always in disarray. If you read political blogs or political professionals, and boy, were they in disarray. Same party in 1860. First of all, they made a huge mistake. As good as it was for Lincoln that the Republicans met in convention in Chicago, it was a terrible idea for the Democrats to meet in Charleston, South Carolina, which is one of my favorite places. It's a beautiful city, but in 1860, it was a hotbed of pro-slavery, radical secessionism, racist pro-slavery politics. And it was a pretty bad place to have a regular meeting where the man that everyone assumed would be the nominee, Stephen Douglas, the senator from Illinois, they were able to pretty much take him down from the beginning of that convention. And then when the platform committee couldn't agree on whether to support Douglas's idea of popular sovereignty or have a federal slave code, the Southern delegates walked out. And so there was no nomination made at the Democrats' convention in Charleston. They had to try again a couple times in Baltimore to even get a nominee, and they ended up with two, a Northern Democratic nominee, Stephen Douglas, and a Southern Democratic nominee, John Breckinridge, who was the sitting vice president. It was truly disarray.
Do you think it would have been a different outcome had the Democrats, remained united?
Historians are terrible predictors. I do think that if the anti-Lincoln voters had been able to unite, they could have easily won the election. And everyone thought that would be Stephen Douglas, like that the Southerners would hold their noses and say, sure, we'll vote for Douglas, just like we voted for James Buchanan, who was a Northern Democrat, just like they voted for Franklin Pierce, who was a Northern Democrat. I do think it would have been a very different outcome.
You're listening to Marginalia. Our guest today is Jonathan Earle, author of He Has the People: Abraham Lincoln and the Election of 1860. So you referred to this a little bit earlier. I'm at KMUW. We are in Wichita, Kansas, and I'm sure I don't represent our listeners when I say this, but I was surprised at how many Kansas connections there were throughout the book. I didn't know about Lincoln's trip to Atchison, to see Bleeding Kansas, for instance. Can you talk a little bit more about the Kansas connections in this book?
I would love to. Let's start with Kansas as an idea, and then we'll talk about Kansas as an actual place. The idea of Kansas is the very reason that Abraham Lincoln got back into national politics. He'd served one term as a congressman from Illinois. He wanted to stay, but the Whig Party of Illinois said, we're good. We're going to try someone else. So he wasn't even renominated after his one term. But that was in 1849. 5 years later, the Kansas-Nebraska Act opens the territory to white settlement, and people rush in from the South, from Missouri, from the North, from Ohio and New York. And Kansas really does explode in the 1850s and becomes the epicenter of this political fight over whether or not slavery would stay where it was in the southern states, or whether it would expand into places like Kansas Territory, where it was supposed to have been banned way back in the Missouri Compromise of 1820. So Lincoln gets back into the game, back on the trail, denouncing the Kansas-Nebraska Act, forming a new Republican Party to stop slavery's expansion. That's Kansas the idea. Lincoln also decided to come to Kansas the place in 1859 at the invitation of I think he was a cousin of his mother, Nancy Hanks, Mark Delahaye, who was a journalist in Kansas and an early Lincoln supporter. So Lincoln made several talks actually in this trip that I think you're right, Beth, not many people know about. So he went to Atchison, he went to Leavenworth, He went to Ellsworth on the Missouri River, and he gave these speeches that I think are really significant because they were tryouts, first drafts for a big speech he gave in New York City later in February of 1860 called the Cooper Union Address. And it's in Kansas that Lincoln is told that John Brown was executed in Charlestown, Virginia, for raiding that arsenal in Harper's Ferry, Virginia. So he talks about John Brown. He says, I know that everyone here knows a lot more about John Brown than anybody else because John Brown was part of Bleeding Kansas. He was in the territory several times, all these connections. And then Kansas sent delegates to the Republican convention, and Lincoln tried very hard to sway them to vote for him in convention instead of Seward on the first ballot. He was only marginally successful in this. They were mostly Seward guys, but Kansas is all over the book. And then one of my favorite illustrations in the book, it's hard to see. It's of a rally that Republican supporters of Lincoln, they swarmed his hometown of Springfield in the summer in August of 1860. And there's really one sign you can see and says, admit me free. And it was women from Kansas who had joined this procession to kind of fête candidate Lincoln. You couldn't really campaign for yourself back in the 19th century. It was seen as unseemly. So Lincoln welcomed all of his supporters to his front yard. So Kansas is the big issue in the campaign, and Kansas was big in Abraham Lincoln's mind.
Since you focus on Lincoln as a politician rather than, beginning with the heroic figure we know from hindsight, did anything surprise you about Lincoln the politician while you were researching the book?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the Mount Rushmore Lincoln and the Lincoln Memorial Lincoln, that's another thing that has always frustrated me about the way historians write about him, as if he was fully formed. You can't be president unless you're a really good politician. And so what surprised me, I think, in researching this book was how adept he was at the minuscule things as well as the big quarterbacking the campaign things. I'll give you an example. He founded with his own money a German language newspaper in Illinois. He knows that those Germans who are coming into the country from the failed revolutions in Central Europe are likely Republican backers. They're reformists. They're kind of some of the early critiquers of authoritarianism in Europe. And so he really wants to reach those guys, and he helps fund their speakers as well. I talk a lot about the Wide Awakes, who are this kind of spontaneous men's marching group that springs up during the campaign. Lincoln realizes that these guys are really powerful examples of showing that the Republican Party has a lot of popular support. What they're supposed to be doing is escorting Republican speakers around a city so they didn't get attacked by their opponents. So I thought Lincoln has these sharp elbows, and he's good at raising money, he's good at spending money, he's good at figuring out how to contrast himself against the other three major candidates. So as someone who respects the art of politics, I really thought he did an impressive job.
You just mentioned that he founded this German language newspaper. So what role did newspapers and political journalism play in shaping the election?
Really important. Newspapers were widely distributed. They were cheap. Everybody read them, men, women, old, young, black, white. And I should say that newspapers and journalism was not supposed to be objective in the 19th century. I think you and I, Beth, grew up in a time when we assumed that newspapers were at least supposed to have an objective outward stance. Maybe the editorial page would lean one way or the other. But in the 19th century, there were papers were Republican newspapers or Constitutional Unionist papers or Democratic papers. And I guess we're kind of going back into that kind of a situation now where we consume our news tells a lot about what we believe and who we may vote for. I think NPR is one of the last holdouts where there really is kind of a coming together in a public square. Lots of views are represented. But I mean, when I watch MS Now or when I watch Fox News, it kind of reminds me of the 19th century. Now, I should say also that you could steal, although it wasn't called stealing, copy from one paper, just clip it out, put it into your paper. So one of the main characters in my book is a young reporter named Murat Halstead from Cincinnati. And he showed up at every one of these political meetings. He went to all seven. And not every paper sent a representative. So Halstead had this outsized effect on the journalism of the period and also of the of the way readers learned about what was happening in Charleston, what was happening in Chicago.
Yeah, wasn't he able to sneak into the execution of John Brown
He,
when no other, they weren't really allowing? Go ahead.
yeah, the governor of Virginia tried to lock down John Brown's execution. He was worried that John Brown's backers would try to break him out of jail. And maybe he was right to worry about that. So it was very militarized. It was very cordoned off from the public. And Murat Halstead was a good reporter, and he blended in, and he was there taking notes, copious notes, and reporting on John Brown's execution. He reported from another thing that I kind of discovered researching this book, a big fight over who the Speaker of the House would be when 1860 started. I'm not a good predictor of the future, as I mentioned, but I know that on January 3rd, 2027, either Michael Johnson or Hakeem Jeffries is going to be elected Speaker of the House in like a 10-second vote. It's not going to be dramatic at all. But boy, it was really dramatic. And Halstead covered this speakership fight very carefully. And then he's so colorful in his depictions and descriptions of the places, of the drinking, of the politicking, that I was overquoting him so much, Beth, that I made him a character in the book.
Well, with that speaker, that was that had to do with people endorsing or wanting that book reprinted or something.
Wow, you're a close reader. There was a book that was published before the election by a anti-slavery Southerner. There were a few of them. He was not a particularly racial egalitarian guy, but he did see in his native North Carolina and elsewhere, and he used statistics to buttress his arguments, that slavery was kind of a loser for the Southern states and their economies. And he saw that the North was gaining in population, in capital assets, in investment, in production of grain, in railroad miles. And he wrote this book that became a flashpoint in the election about, it's called The Impending Crisis of the South. And the people who ran the government, the Southern slaveholders, frankly, who ran the government, tried to make it, if you had signed on to a petition supporting the ideas of this book, that you would be anathema to serving in leadership posts in Congress. And so that is one of the reasons why the speakership, it was supposed to be this guy named John Sherman from Ohio, and he had signed on, he supported him, the impending crisis of the South, and they kept him from achieving his majority for 59 votes. And finally, some guy from New Jersey named Tompkins became the Speaker of the House. There's no reason anyone would remember him now, but the fact that it took Congress so long to organize, they couldn't even get paid, Beth. It was really kind of a mess. And it was I would say, a kind of microcosm or a foreshadowing of the nation breaking apart in 1861.
They didn't get paid then, and now when everything shuts down, they are the first to be paid. But
The first to get paid, and they can trade stocks too.
you do make the 1860 campaign feel surprisingly modern. Are there similarities between 19th century campaigning and presidential politics today?
Yeah, I think there are lots and lots of echoes. One of my least favorite words of our current political descriptions is unprecedented. Everything that's happening now is unprecedented. And I'm not denying that we live in kind of difficult, divided, brutal times, but I think almost everything is precedented and precedented on 19th century things. So violence, the threat of political violence, precedented. Messing around with the mail to achieve your political ends, precedented. Divided Democrats, precedented. I think we can all learn a lot about our current political problems by studying the past. And I hope some people see some of those echoes if they read He Has the People.
I've never claimed to know much about history, so I did appreciate you explaining, some of history's influence on political terms today, like where the term battleground states comes from. But I also learned about groups that I've never heard of. You mentioned the Wide Awakes, and I did not know about the Know-Nothings.
Yeah.
What made you fall down the rabbit hole of history?
Personally, I grew up in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., and I love the Smithsonian and the monuments. And I actually, going to Harper's Ferry when I was a kid, it's about an hour and 10-minute train ride from where I grew up. I just love being in places that are connected to history. And I lived in Kansas, in Eastern Kansas, for 17 years when I was a professor at KU. And I loved taking guests and interested people down to Pottawatomie Creek, which is now on private land. You have to kind of bushwhack there, showing them Osawatomie, where the Battle of Osawatomie took place. the Battle of Blackjack in Douglas County. I love being in places where historical events happened, especially ones that people don't realize are as significant as they are. So I've always been a history nerd, and luckily went to a college that had a great history department and got to live in a historically significant place like Kansas for all those years.
After spending years immersed in the election of 1860, what do you think Lincoln's greatest political achievement actually was?
There are a few of them. I'm going to put the Emancipation Proclamation way up there. Now, it didn't emancipate really a single slave. It only affected places where the Union Army had occupied southern places. Yet it turned the war from one of preserving the Union into one of emancipation and freeing the enslaved people of the South. That became the war aim. I think that's his greatest contribution. And I'll also say, remember we used to complain about politicians who flip-flopped or who waffled? I want to kind of make a big pro argument for flip-flopping. I like it when a politician becomes wiser, learns from her or his mistakes, and becomes better. And that's the way I see Lincoln. Lincoln does not start off as a emancipator. He starts off as, I want to preserve the Union. If I can do it by freeing zero slaves, I'll pick that. If I have to free all the slaves, I'll do that. But it was all about preserving the Union. And by 1863, as the war is going on, he understands both the military significance of the Emancipation Proclamation and the moral significance of the Emancipation Proclamation. He changes. And by the time he is near his assassination in 1865, he has actually come out in favor of a very radical idea for the time, suffrage for some black voters. And for him, it was men who had served in the Union Army and the very intelligent. Again, that's not a huge swath of the population, but black suffrage was where he got by April of 1865. And that's a far cry from the politician of 1860. So I think that's something that we should admire when a politician grows. And then he also, out of nowhere, he never served in a formal war. He fought in the Black Hawk War, which was a skirmish against Native peoples in the West briefly as a volunteer. But he became a great military strategist. He knew a lot more than some of his generals about how the South had to be brought completely to heel, had to be totally defeated, and there couldn't be a peace that preserved slavery in any way, shape, or form.
How long does research and writing and publishing a book like this take? How long have you been in this time period in your head?
Well, you never ask a lady her age. You never ask a long time. Now, I've got a side hustle where I'm the dean of an honors college these days, and so I have this job that I do from 9 to 5. So it took me a long time. I've been thinking about this, Beth, since probably 2008, 2009. I signed a contract about 10 years ago, and then I finally was able to wrest some leave from my day job in the fall of 2014 when I did a lot of the writing. But it takes a long time. And that's why when you read a work of nonfiction like this, I just want you to think about how hard it is to do the research trips, to read all those documents, to think of how to put it together as a narrative. And then since your show is so much about the writing process, it took me a long time to figure out how to have these characters. I have two that I mentioned today already. I mentioned Murat Halstead, who's a reporter, and he becomes my tour guide through the political convention season. It's really nice to have that. And then I have this young guy who's a volunteer firefighter named Charles Duxie O'Neill, who I found his correspondence at the New York Public Library with his girlfriend, where he talks all about being a wide awake during this campaign. Most of his correspondence is because he served in the Civil War, like many of the wide awakes. He survived, by the way. I was really happy to report, and married the girl, Carrie. So the O'Neills survived the Civil War as an intact couple. But I wanted to tell the story with not famous first person people who were actually there. So that's hard. Of course, Lincoln has lots of writing and papers that fill shelves and shelves in libraries, and some of these guys are really famous. But I liked kind of figuring out what normal people thought during this campaign.
It must be difficult to find time to write when you have that side hustle of being a dean. Was the vocabulary more erudite back then? I mean, I quoted, and I don't even know how to say some of these words, a dismal vaticination of the ultimate catastrophe of the election of William H. Seward? I mean,
Yeah. I don't think people were better educated. People are definitely better educated now. I think there was more of a sense of to use in a newspaper a highfalutin 50-cent word like that was not uncommon. And I think Lincoln is a good example. Lincoln had no formal education himself, but he taught himself. You know, he claimed that his favorite book was Euclid's Geometry. I don't know if he was trying to, you know, make himself sound smarter than he was, but he really had to be an autodidact and learn. Oh, sorry, that's a 50-cent word, isn't it? He had to learn. He had to teach himself because no one was teaching him. So I do think that there's something about that. There's more of a literary flair to some of this writing. And you know, I've heard. I'm not a linguist, but that apparently Donald Trump speaks at like essentially a like third grade level, and it works for him. So there might be kind of a populist way to communicate that is more 21st century than in the 1860s. But I love reading 19th century articles, prose, letters, and I do sometimes have to have a dictionary present.
Are there any misconceptions about the 1860 election that you hope readers will reconsider after reading your book? Or do you have a hope for what readers will take away from He Has the People?
Yeah, I think the biggest misconception might be that it was all kind of foreordained, and of course Lincoln was going to win. It just was not true. That was weird. And I liken it in a little bit. I mean, I know they're both from Illinois, but like at the beginning of the 2008 political campaign, if you said that, you know, this brand new senator from Illinois named Barack Obama was likely to win the nomination against Hillary Clinton or beat the Republicans, I would have said you were kind of crazy, right? You don't really know how this is going to come out. We don't know what's going to happen in the midterms, and that's only 2 months from now. So I think that was what was frustrating to me about the extant history of the election. There are always surprises, and there's always hope. I know it seems like for a lot of people are very disenchanted with our politics, and I see a lot of people saying, I'm not going to participate anymore. And I would urge them, please don't. Democracy is fragile. Democracy needs people to participate, to vote, to march, and to support candidates that they believe are the good guys and good gals.
Is there anything that you want to talk about that I didn't ask?
I love speaking to Kansas audiences, as if you couldn't already tell. That I would say a Kansas audience is one that is better educated in 19th century US history than any other place in the country. And I'm including Washington, D.C., Chicago, Illinois, you name it, certainly Baton Rouge, Louisiana. So I am really fortunate to be appearing next week on Wednesday, the 16th of September at the Johnson County Museum. The very next night on the 17th of September at the Lawrence Public Library. And then in Topeka the following Thursday, the 24th, at the Future of Kansas Summit. So if anyone likes what I'm saying and wants to hear more, they can show up there. And I really do hope to add some Wichita dates as well. So get to Southern Kansas during this book tour.
Well, the book is He Has the People, Abraham Lincoln and the Election of 1860. Jonathan Earle, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Beth. I love marginalia, so it's cool to be on.
He Has the People, Abraham Lincoln and the Election of 1860 by Jonathan Earle was published by Oxford University Press. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR network. Our editors and producers for this week's show are Haley Krausen and Luann Stevens. Torin Anderson composed our theme music. This is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay.
I haven't seen my son since 2012.
This is Deborah Tice. The disappearance of her son, Austin, is one of the biggest missing person cases in the world.
What do you want from me?
I want you to solve the mystery.
I know that my son is somewhere alive.
Listen to Where is Austin Tice from NPR's Embedded and BBC Radio 4 on the NPR app or wherever you get your podcasts.